Like the office they commemorate, presidential libraries are living institutions. Certainly, it is my hope that the Reagan Library will become a dynamic intellectual forum where scholars interpret the past and policymakers debate the future.
Welcome to a Reagan Forum, hosted by the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation and Institute. The Center for Public Affairs offers lectures and forums presenting perspectives on important public policy issues of the day, from politicians, authors, members of the media, business and military leaders, and more. In this week's Reagan Forum, we go back just 2 days for our in-person event with Fox News host Pete Hegseth. Pete joined us to discuss his new book, Battle for the American Mind, Uprooting a Century of Miseducation. Pete Hegseth joined Fox News Channel in 2014, first as a contributor, but now as a co-host of Fox & Friends Weekend. In addition, over the past few years, Pete has hosted Fox News Channel's New Year's coverage, most recently ringing in 2022 from the Wild Horse Saloon in Nashville, Tennessee. After graduating college, Pete was commissioned as an infantry officer into the U.S. Army National Guard in 2003. In 2004, his unit was called to Guantanamo Bay, where he served as an infantry platoon leader. Shortly after returning from Cuba, Pete volunteered to serve in Baghdad and Samarra, where he held the position of infantry platoon leader, and later in Samarra as a civil military operations officer. Over the past 6 years, Pete Hegseth has also become a New York Times bestselling author. During today's program, Pete sat down in conversation to discuss the battle for the American mind, Uprooting a Century of Miseducation, which he calls a field guide for remaking schools in the United States. Let's listen.
Welcome both.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for being here. Yeah. Appreciate it.
Just some quick biographical stuff first, Pete. Pete, you, as I was noting, you were in the armed services, heck of a basketball player in high school. I don't think you started off your career as a commentator, as a news guy. How did you and Fox News ever meet?
Good question. My first television appearance ever was on MSNBC's Hardball with Chris Matthews. I'd never done TV before in my life, and I had a Marine buddy of mine who'd done TV twice, so he was an expert. And he told me, he said, just lean forward. That's his first tip. And it makes you look, you know, better stature, better posture. Lean forward and don't let the host cut you off. 46 times Chris Matthew cut me off. So I was a newbie. I didn't ever anticipate I'd go into TV. I ran a couple of vets organizations when I came back from Iraq and then Afghanistan, one supporting the warfighter in the battlefield and then another one fighting for reform at the VA, which is still an ongoing issue, obviously. And through that, I ended up doing appearances on TV in different places. And a lot of it ended up being Fox, and a lot of it ended up being Fox and Friends. And then, yeah, I'll never forget, one day they said, have you ever thought about asking questions instead of answering them? I said, I'm happy to try anything one time. The worst thing I could do is make a fool of myself. And it must have gone okay. And that was in 2015, early 2016. And then Tucker Carlson, who was the Fox and Friends weekend host, took the primetime gig, and thank goodness, because he's amazing. And then I took Tucker's slot on Fox and Friends weekend, and that's where I've been ever since.
Yeah, neat. Yeah, and the rest is history. David, I'm not sure if it was your pen that wrote these words or Pete's in the book, because it's co-author, but in the foreword, or right up there in the front, there was a note about the fact that when the two of you got together, it felt kind of like Indiana Jones and his father, and one was Sean Connery. And one was Harrison Ford. So my first question to you is, well, which of you is Sean Connery and which of you?
We'll leave that to the imagination. But I'm older than Pete, so.
He looks like Sean Connery, doesn't he?
Can't pull off the accent.
How did the two of you get together for this book?
You sure? I won't monopolize, I promise. I was at a Fox and Friends diner in North Carolina, and there was a beautiful young family in the corner who had their two young daughters there in their uniforms. And as I do with every diner, I walked around, was talking to everybody, and I talked to them, and they were talking about this wonderful school, Sand Hills Classical Christian School in North Carolina, that they sent their kids to. And I had known about classical Christian school, but my interest had peaked around that point. I want to learn more. The school system is broken. What do we do? And they said, you got to meet this guy, David Goodwin. He runs the Association of Classical Christian Schools. You got to shoot him an email. And so I did. I shot him an email. I said, I want to learn more. What do you guys do? And he shot me tons of information. He had already done a lot of writing and research on this topic. And I kept reading it. I'm calling him. I'm calling him too much, I think, like over on a regular basis. I'm calling, David, I got a question about this. Can this really be true? Is this true? And then at one point, I remember looking at my wife. I'm sitting in my office, and I said, babe, she runs, by the way, a lot of the live stuff on Fox Nation. And I said, we got to make a movie out of this. Like, people need to know what is going on, from John Dewey to the original Pledge of Allegiance, which we can get into that, to the Bellamy Salute, to what the progressives did and how they used prohibition, the whole story. And what David had done and the research he'd done was just, it was a no-brainer. And so we got to work on the film and then eventually the book. But none of this happens without David Goodwin and the research and expertise he brings to the topic.
Mm-hmm. Now, I bet that just about everyone in this audience has now some familiarity with this whole critical race theory being taught in our nation's schools today. But what I found fascinating in this book is right up front, the two of you make the point that that's just a very recent tip of the iceberg. This problem is really as much as 100 years old. So one of you please explain that.
Please.
Well, it is. What's really an amazing part of the story of the development of the book is that we started in March of 2020. Which, if you remember, that's before CRT went front and center. It was before the George Floyd riots. It was before even COVID. So the interest early on was Pete and I were thinking this story needs to be told of what was happening in the early part of the 20th century because nobody's told the story. But as we went along, history was unfolding in front of us, and the schools were deeply involved. And Pete kept coming back with, hey, what about this? I had this person on TV today. They said this. Have you ever looked into this? And so pretty soon, it was a truly collaborative project where Pete was writing. He's written most of the parts of the book that deal with contemporary issues of our day. And what we found out is they fit together like, you know, hand in glove. I mean, John Dewey no sooner gets through with his work that I researched in Columbia University than the Frankfurt School shows up. And Pete had a lot better grasp on that side of things than I did. So as a whole, I think the work was really providential. It was something that wouldn't have come together had it not been the time and the place and the partnership.
Pete? Yeah, I mean, the progressives had the targeting of our youngest minds on their mind from the very beginning.
Right.
They knew they had to remove the one immovable object inside American civic life and in Western civilization if their schemes were to ever catch on. And they understood that immovable object was God, was faith, and that it was at the centerpiece of the American classroom since the founding. And they had to replace it. The way we describe it is, to keep the Indiana Jones analogy going, it's like when you're trying to grab a precious artifact, but it's on a pressure plate. And if you take that artifact off the pressure plate, the alarm bells go off. If they had removed God immediately 100 years ago, the parents, the culture, the communities, the churches would have revolted. And so they openly wrote in the New Republic and other publications, and this is the research that David did, they openly discussed, how do we remove God from the classrooms? That's the immovable object. And they ultimately landed on a forgery, which the culture at the time was willing to accept, which effectively was allegiance to the state. It was the flag. It was a new pledge, a pledge of allegiance written by a socialist that didn't say under God when it was originally written. I love the flag. I proudly said the pledge of allegiance today at the beginning. I revere it. For them, it was a new idea around which they could get society cohere that was more malleable, that nationalism being more malleable than biblical truth. because when you have biblical truth and objective truth, you can't move people off of that. So they what you'll find when you read this story from the characters is almost to a man and to a woman, they are atheists, humanists, socialists, and then eventually Marxists, who reject biblical truth, who reject the idea of human nature and our fallen nature, sinful nature. And once you can change and reject that, then you create a laboratory for societal change inside classrooms. And one of the other things that David discovered through his research and we write about is the early progressives studied one of the first successful social movements, which was prohibition. A woman named Margaret, what was her name? Frances Willard, because I always get Frances Bellamy and Frances Willard up. Frances Willard, who's a suffragette, a socialist, said, if we can put it into the curriculum of third graders, maybe we start to have a chance. So in the 1870s, third grade curriculum, anti-alcohol was put into classrooms. It was still an ad hoc system. This is before John Dewey. This is Horace Mann. These are loose public school associations. But a third grade curriculum was put in. By 1919, what do you have in America? Prohibition of the sale and consumption of alcohol. And the progressives said, wait, if you can do that with third grade curriculum, what else can you do with third grade curriculum? And they discovered a word called paideia, or they didn't discover it, they knew it. So did our founders. I've learned it from David, and we talk about it in the book, which is how you educate and train up the youngest. And if you can shape the youngest of minds to have a different understanding of the value of a good life, you change the entire way a society and a civilization looks at what they value.
Well, so as we said, the pledge, one nation under God, indivisible. Would you go so far as to say that, well, when socialists and those who created the pledge were after what you've described, to them, under God, God essentially is the state. It's not a...
Yes, originally, but the original pledge written by Frances Bellamy did not include under God. Mm-hmm. Under God was added by Eisenhower when we were fighting the godless communists in the 50s. Mm. So the original pledge has no mention of God. Mm. And to oversimplify, basically what the progressives did, they said, and it was always under the guise of vocational training for a new economy, but what they did is they replaced a cross and a Bible in the classroom with a flag and a pledge. Over time, gradually speaking, while saying, okay, we're going to start a different type of school over here where, yeah, God's not allowed inside, but we have a pullout period where you can go to instruction outside of the school, not on school grounds, but we still respect that you have faith in God. So it was always incremental. And then when they moved it to New York, they took a different approach. And you should explain the idea of the Gary Plan, David, because that's one of the things that blew my mind. They started a school in Gary, Indiana, that intentionally tried to change the way school worked altogether, K-12.
Right. Their intentionality was visible because they created these model schools and actually several places around the country, but Gary became the center point of it. And the thing about Gary was, anybody who knows the town, you may know it from the musical or whatever, but it was formed in about 1905. So it was a very new city, and they could take the education wherever they wanted to take it. So one of Dewey's disciples was the superintendent of that area, and they built the Gary's Plan there in Indiana. And its features were things you probably all thought were always in school, like bells that ring at the end of a 55-minute period, the seven-period day, the idea of subjects broken up and the social sciences being inserted into it. And Pete talks a lot about the social sciences element. I'll leave that to you later. But this was all packaged up, and they removed religion, Christianity, from the classroom by simply putting it in a pullout period. And where I first encountered this story was when I was reading the back and forth in the editorial pages of the New Republic between 1915 and 1918, where they're arguing about how to get God out of the classroom for good. Because the one side was saying, hey, if we put it in a pullout period, we can eventually just drop it. The other side was saying, we shouldn't have a pullout period, especially when you import it back into New York, which is what happened with the Gary Plan. It was successful, so they imported it back in New York. So the whole modern American experience, especially in high school, was designed in Gary, and it was designed without God. It was the first design of that type.
In the book, you describe at some length this whole woke movement. And, you know, part of being woke is, hey, you're invading my space. Hey, those words are harmful, you know, all the rest of that. I read this. I just could not believe it when I read it in your book. And that is that our United States, the National Archives and Record Administration, the agency that is the nation's attic, it keeps all of our records and takes care of the Constitution of the United States and the Declaration of Independence. When you access the archives website, it suggests up in the top right-hand corner, there are harmful warning, there are harmful words in these documents. How can this possibly be?
It's true. You go to the website of our National Archive for the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of our United States of America, and there is a trigger warning of potential violent content, inappropriate content. Now, that's the logical extent of the view of the left. You see, they want to reject, they have rejected the ideas of our founding, and their theories were dedicated to that from the beginning of when they landed on our shores. So David talked about the early progressives, John Dewey and other names you'll be introduced to. Then you have the critical theorists of the Frankfurt School who flee Germany. They're all Marxists. They flee Hitler. They land in New York, and they are welcomed at Columbia University, where John Dewey had been a professor. What is John Dewey at that? What is Columbia at that time, and what is Columbia Teachers College still today? The preeminent teachers' college in the United States of America. And the Marxists arrive with a new theory called critical theory. Sound familiar? It's the precursor to critical race theory and critical gender theory. And they begin to teach it, and they begin to teach it in the teachers' colleges, which means when those teachers go out and become heads of their departments or other places, they're teaching critical theory. And what is critical theory, to your point? Critical theory is its premise is to deconstruct effectively Western Christian paideia or Western civilization. It is criticize all things that lead to the white Euro patriarchy capitalist system that must be torn down if we're to advance Marxism. They thought in an economic sense, but it soon became a cultural sense because they knew the bourgeoisie proletariat class warfare wasn't going to fly in the United States of America. Instead, our terrible past of racial injustice was more fertile ground. And so the critical theorists eventually landed on critical race theory as the way in which they could indict America from the very beginning. And we call the first chapter of our book the COVID-16-19 moment. Because COVID-19 happens, the Zoom classroom comes into all of our homes, and you open up the laptop, and in American history, they're teaching 1619 is the new founding date. It's because they have rejected 1776 and the principles thereof, and they're indicting America from the very beginning as being a terrible country. So that type of logic at the academic level, which has now made its way pervasively into the K-12, of course leads government institutions to say that the Declaration and the Constitution need trigger warnings, because they were written by slave owners, and therefore they must be canceled. And we need to find a new founding date, and all the wisdom that they had, despite their flaws, has to be rejected. See, that was the premise of critical theory from the very beginning. So they used to only teach it in higher education, and now all the teachers that have been through the teachers' colleges and handle the accreditation that have gone, that are now in bed with the unions, and by the way, I see Rebecca Friedrichs here, who's a great friend of ours, was in our film, Miseducation of America. She wrote Standing Up to Goliath. She took on the teachers' unions in California for 30 years, was a teacher, just an amazing individual. So we've drawn on a lot of wisdom from a lot of people who've been on the front lines of this, and frankly, we're yelling about it before people were paying attention, and now they are paying attention. But those theories have been embedded into our institutions, and that's how you get to the point where something like that appears on a website.
Well explained. This is why you have to read this book. Really well done. I'll pull a quote from your book, and I'd like you to explain it for us. The right has long held the right principles, but the left controls the positions. What do you mean by that?
Want to?
It's a political question. You get it.
What do I mean by that? What I mean is, you know, look at local school boards. Look at, you know, union representation. Look at our universities. Look at, we stand on principles that we know are timeless and believe that they should be timeless and that they do stand on their own, whether they're the brilliance of our founding or the wisdom, the biblical wisdom. And then the left goes ahead and runs for all the positions, takes over all the institutions, and then pushes out all the stuff we thought was timeless and would be there no matter what. If there's one thing you could fault the founders for, it's assuming that this type of education would continue, that it's how kids would be educated at some level, with an understanding of Greek and Latin and great books and our biblical Western civilization narrative. That they kind of assumed that would be the waters that we swim in, and they hadn't anticipated the critical theorists and others who came about after that and tried to deconstruct everything that they did. So that's why we're not trying to be pessimistic in this book, but you guys remember the stuff we covered on Fox of parents rising up at school boards, right? Loudoun County, Virginia, Glenn Youngkin gets elected. It's all amazing stuff, and it's wonderful to see, and it's heartening, and I mean that sincerely. But those types of actions in today's government schools, because that's what we should call them, they're government schools. Public schools are government schools. Those types of actions, as we say in the book, I feel like it's like charging a fortified machine gun nest with Nerf guns. We salute your effort, but we're going to bury you all. Because those school boards, what do they do to those parents 95% of the time? You know, good luck. See you later. Next. And what changed? My mom protested at PTA meetings in the school board in the 1980s and 90s when I was in elementary and high school. And God bless her. She took me out of those courses, whether it was the new sex ed course or this new Quest self-esteem thing that's quite benign by today's standards, but she recognized it for what it is back then. And she protested, and she pulled me out. Well, guess what happened at Forest Lake Elementary School and Central Middle School? Nothing. 99% of the other kids at Forest Lake High School still went through that education and still got the Quest program, and now we're on our 95th iteration of that at Forest Lake High School in conservative Minnesota. They control the pipeline of every aspect of the educational industrial complex. The unions being their most powerful arm of that, but the teachers' colleges, the textbooks, the curriculums, the certifications, the accreditations, all hard leftists. So we want to disavow people of the idea that you can move to a nice zip code or I'm going to move to a conservative community and everything's going to be okay. The problem is the pipeline has been federalized and taken, and they control those positions. And so protesting is good and doing something for your kid is good, but we argue it's utterly insufficient at this point.
And if I could add just the one thing, the money involved is the icing on the cake. It's the biggest industrial complex, even rivaling the military industrial complex in this country, dollar for dollar. So not only is the infrastructure solidly in the hands of the progressives, but the money is too.
Yeah. Pete, you went to what has to be defined as an elite school for university. But in the book, the both of you note that your quest was to find not an elite education, but rather the best education. What is the difference between the elite education and a best education? You're an expert.
Well, by today's standards, an elite education would be Princeton, where I went as an undergraduate, or Harvard, where I went as for a master's program. But I don't know if you saw on Fox and Friends recently. I did bust open my diploma to Harvard and write return to sender and mail it back to him live on TV. Because our most elite institutions are poisoning the minds of our, not just our kids, but our country. And if we hold them up as standard bearers of excellence and gatekeepers of credibility, then we just continue the cycle of perpetuation. By the way, it's not just my so-called elite backgrounds, it's probably your alma maters too. Take your pick. unless you went to Hillsdale or Liberty or, you know, College of the Ozarks, I saw one back there, your university is probably dutifully pumping out hard leftists and Marxists at a rapid pace. Read your alumni newsletter. Go back and take some coursework. Just peruse the website. Yet we just, by default, because we like the sports teams or the nostalgia of drinking beer in college, we pump checks to these institutions. And we might as well just send it straight to the Democrat Party. And so any part of perpetuating that, I believe, is part of perpetuating a cycle that's hurting our country. So when I say the best institutions, what I'm talking about are David schools. I'm talking about classical Christian schools at the K through 12 level. Because my mentor at Princeton, his name is Robbie George, he's an amazing conservative constitutional professor. By the way, there's a renaissance at Princeton of conservatives. There are now 25 outed conservatives in the faculty at Princeton. All because of one man who started an institution and has built it. It's phenomenal. But he has a quote in our book where he says, it used to be the liberal professors that licked their chops at indoctrinating these naive, you know, Bible-clinging kids that showed up at college. And now it's the exact opposite. It's the conservative professors, the few among them, who lick their chops at undoing the indoctrination of the kids who already show up woke and indoctrinated. See, the problem's not higher education. Higher education's already gone. The problem is K through 12. That's the focus of our book. And they're consolidating that on K through 12. And when I talk about a great education, not an elite education, the kids David pumps out are elite. They're elite performers. They're elite students. They're elite critical thinkers. They're elite debaters. They're ready to go into the culture and engage and win. So by that definition of elite, they are elite. If you mean elite by pay $50,000 so your kid can be woke, they're not elite. That's what a lot of the elite high schools or middle schools look like that are pipelines to the Ivy League. These are pipelines to wisdom, timeless wisdom, the type of education that our founders received that gave them the ability to debate what they debated 250 years ago and create this form of government that is a republic if we can keep it. I didn't get that education, and I got a standard, you know, every time I'd talk to David, the first thing I would say to him is, why can't I go back to one of your schools? Because I learned almost nothing. No, if I look back at the social studies that I learned, and we all took social studies. I bet you all did. Social sciences, social studies, political sciences. Guess what? All disciplines made up by Marxists. All of them. It used to be geography and philosophy and theology and civics and politics. They deconstructed it to dumb it down, to make it all a scientific method that could be explained because there's no more objective truth. We all got a progressive education and we didn't know it. What David's doing is unearthing a hidden form of education that the progressives almost completely buried by the 1970s and is now giving a generation of Americans a chance to actually get educated. My seventh grader, who's been in a classical Christian school now for 6 years, understands ancient Greece and Rome better than I ever will, which means he's engaging with the big ideas that the founders engaged with as he goes into a culture totally awash and devoid of them. That's what I would call elite. And that's how I would like to try to redefine it.
Wow.
More from our Reagan Forum with Pete Hegseth after this message.
The Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation is the nonprofit organization created by President Reagan himself and specifically charged by him with continuing his legacy and sharing his principles, individual liberty, economic opportunity, global democracy, and national pride. We must remain vigilant and work together to share these conservative principles with younger generations. Your role is critical to move our mission forward. Thank you for your continued support. Please visit reaganfoundation.org/give. That's reaganfoundation.org/give.
Now, back to our Reagan Forum with Pete Hegseth.
Following on that, perhaps the two of you launch off from this sentence in your book. What you note is the problem is not what's being taught in our schools, but what's not being taught in our schools. So give some examples of a classical Christian education that you think will in fact develop elite thinkers? And
well, one of the things that we have a tendency to do, I think, is take for granted things that history gave us so long ago we've forgotten. The seven liberal arts, which are the basis of classical Christian education, they date back to the ancient Greeks. And the principle was that if you were going to form some type of republic or democracy, you had to prepare your children to think for themselves. Because if they just listened to whatever doctrine somebody gave them, they would vote for the tyrant. Because and you're going to go back into tyranny. That was the fear of the Greeks. It was the fear of the Romans. And it was the basis of this country when they built the country. That's why we have eagles on our stanchions, right? And many other Roman artifacts, because they were hearkening back to this idea that a republic requires free-thinking people. So the seven liberal arts, the first three, which is what I'll talk about briefly here, grammar, logic, and rhetoric, training in how to use language well, training in how to use logic and to think well through the study of both formal and informal logic and the practice. One of the things we do in classical schools is we practice thinking. We don't tell kids what to think. We practice them in the art of good thinking. Very different kind of education. It's not one teacher standing in front of a room of 25 kids and telling them what to think. They're around tables. They're engaging each other. They're trying, you know, to learn to argue well. And the third subject in the trivium is rhetoric, which now is a dirty word because politics kind of shuffled it up. But it was originally the art of understanding the comprehensive whole of a topic and being able to communicate that to other people and persuade them to follow you, which of course is the heart of a democracy. It's the heart of a republic, is to have discourse. And what we're seeing right now in our country is discourse is being shut down from every angle because we can't stand to hear things we don't like to hear.
Yeah. And the solution is not necessarily, if you're a parent out there and you're trying to figure out, well, where should I send my child to school? The solution, public schools are the government schools you've talked about, which are the real problem. But the solution is not necessarily, well, I'll spend $50,000 and send my kid to a private or independent prep school, correct?
Correct. In fact, I would argue that most of the private schools are even worse and more woke. In fact, a lot of the Christian schools and Catholic schools are maybe not as bad on the surface in every way that you see that, but they're still built completely on the progressive model of education. That's what I think, that's what shook me so much at the beginning in working with David, is once you start to dig into it and realize, he likens it to a capsized ship. You know, if you've been living in a capsized ship for 100 years, you feel like the wall is the floor, and that's what you've lived in. But then when you tip the capsized ship back up and you realize you've been living sideways for 100 years, everything looks completely different. That's what David's movement has had to do since the 1980s. Is revive a lost form of education because it was almost completely gone. There were, I would say, the darkest days of education in this country were the 1970s when there was no such thing as classical Christian, and they almost outlawed homeschooling. They were very close to doing so. They tried to outlaw all parochial schooling as well in Oregon earlier and before that. They'd still like to if they could. Thank goodness for the Supreme Court and the ruling we got just last week in Maine, amongst other fabulous rulings. It's been a good week for our founders and their structure of government, and for so many other leaders in this country, including Ronald Reagan, who have been fighters for life for generations. And here we are. It's a beautiful thing.
Well,
I would just say that you have to break down the assumptions that you have about what education means, especially in a Christian context. And that's why I think classical Christian is so different. And what we've tried to do is break down the preconceived notions of classical means outdated, dusty, old, kind of like how people have looked at homeschooling. Well, homeschooling means, you know, weird or not socialized, which is not the case. And if you look at how it's done today and done so well, it's amazing what they're doing in homeschooling, and including pods and co-ops and online curriculum and classical Christian homeschooling. I mean, there are more options today than there have ever been for a great education for your kids and grandkids, which is, I think, one of the good news stories out of this. David has almost 500 brick and mortar classical Christian schools across the country in 46 states. There's a bunch here in California. There's a bunch across the country. Now, we argue for parents and grandparents taking a radical reorientation of your lives and saying, next to your family and next to your faith, the next step you can take is where you educate your kids, where they spend 16,000 hours between the age of kindergarten and 12th grade. 16,000 hours, that was the original working title of the book, 16,000 Hour War, because that's what it is. Do you really want to send your kids to 16,000 hours of Democrat camp? Because that's basically what we're doing right now when we send our kids to 90% of the K-12 schools that exist in America today. I would argue you don't want that. And even in some of the articles that David uncovered, the progressives wrote about that. And in fact, you would know the quote better than me. What chance does 1 hour of theistic training on Sunday morning have against 40 hours of secular training during the week? Who said that, David? I can't remember.
Charles Potter.
They knew from the beginning. And frankly, the Christian church, we did it to ourselves as a movement. When the church abdicated its responsibility on education, David writes so beautifully about this, there's the social justice arm and then the fundamentalist arm. Ultimately, the social justice arm joins with the progressives, and the fundamentalist arm says, well, we're just here to save souls, which is wonderful, but it basically said, we're not in the school business anymore. What got created at that moment? Sunday school. Mm-hmm. So instead of sending our kids to a school Monday through Friday that has God in it, we take God out of the schools and we send them to school for 1 hour on Sunday. And then you see what happens as a result. So I would look very closely at any elite school, any private school, and any Christian school, and look at the baseline prerogatives of what they teach and compare it against the liberal arts classical approach that David has, and I think you'll see a stark difference.
Don, if I could just draft on that real quick. It's exhibit A in what we were talking about with the deep educational state, where they control accreditation, teacher certification, teachers' colleges, because it doesn't matter if you go to a Christian high school or an independent prep school, they're all trained in that system. So that's the point we were trying to make, is that the reason they're woke is because they get the same training as everybody else. The prescription we have in the book is get out and go a totally different direction.
Tactical retreat is what we call it.
Yeah.
That sometimes when you're surrounded in this immediate moment, the first movement is retreat. And then we argue in the book for an educational insurgency, the form of warfare of the weak against the strong, the small against the big. David started that insurgency through his schools. And, you know, we're seeing Arizona just had a universal educational tax credit program. It's a beautiful thing that there's some movement there.
We're going to turn it to the audience for questions in just a minute, but I want two trigger words, I'll call them, that you said, Pete, that remind me. As first is, you know, the Reagan Foundation and Institute, we're blessed in that we're able to give $1 million in college scholarships. Wow. Each and every year to often between 10 and 20 students. And what we are finding is that more and more of those that have risen to the top that become finalist competitors are homeschooled. It's really been a fascinating thing to watch. Second thing, before we go to questions from the audience, I wanted to just read a quote from Michael's father here, President Reagan, in his farewell speech to the nation in January of 1989. The president said, "An informed patriotism is what we want. Are we doing a good enough job teaching our children what America is and what she represents in the long history of the world and what it means to be an American? We've got to teach history based not on what's in fashion, but what's important. If we forget what we did, we won't know who we are. I'm warning of an eradication of the American memory that could result ultimately in an erosion of the American spirit.
Amen.
Right?
Amen.
That's it.
That was the end. At the beginning of Reagan's term, he commissioned an educational assessment of America. And I can't get this quote right, but it essentially concluded that if a foreign country had done this, we would have called it an act of war.
Yeah.
Look it up. It's the report coming out.
We'd like to turn to you, the audience, for questions. Just a quick primer. If you have a question, of course, raise your hand. But please wait until we get a microphone put in your hand so that we can hear your question. Questions? So we have one right here near the front.
Hi. Thank you very much. Pete, question for you. Because of your occupation and perhaps the circles you travel in, do you encounter media from the left and ever have discussions with them on their positions? Do you ever go have a banter with them, go back and forth, or do you pretty much stay to people on the right? How does it work in your profession?
Just when I talked to Juan Williams. I would love to. I have no... First of all, I get a chance to work with some of the best conservatives in the business, with Rachel Campos Duffy and Will Cain and the guys. We're chock full of them at Fox, and I'm grateful for that. I will say this. The left-wing media is not the most tolerant bunch in the world these days. Not only would they not want to have a conversation with me, I would count myself as someone who's gone to some pretty left-wing universities and hung around. I'm happy to have a conversation with you knowing we disagree and know that we're probably going to come to a different conclusion at the end of the conversation. The problem is these days you talk to most members of the media on the left side of the aisle, and the only way that conversation is going to go is they're going to end by saying, you're a racist. No, I mean, really, that's what it devolves. It's an absolute mischaracterization, straw man characterization of the opponent as less than human. I have the private conversations I have with people left of center at Fox are wonderful. Wonderful. Because they're at a place that actually tolerates. And one quick anecdote, I have a bunch of friends that have worked at CNN who are conservatives. Every single one of them has gone running for the exits. Because eventually they're cornered and run out and screamed at and told what horrible human beings are. Especially if they supported Trump. I mean, find the door, or you're going to sit on the shelf and never be on TV. I've never met a liberal that works at Fox that didn't say, this is the most wonderful place I've ever worked. Because we do tolerate. Yeah, we have discussions on the air, and we have it out. But at the end of the day, I can ask them about their kids and their life, and what do you think about this? And they'll compliment me on the book, and oh, I saw this. So it can exist when you foster an environment that it exists. And that environment, I believe at Fox, is the shared value that America is a good country. And God is worth celebrating. When you can agree on the basics, then you can figure the other stuff out.
Yeah, well said. Over here.
You're going to hold it? Okay. Thank you so much for both of you being here. I'm so excited to read your book. It's a little overwhelming to listen, and I have three millennial kids that haven't had kids yet, but do you have a suggestion as to how we can communicate, besides just giving them the book, or how do we, and also, it's a two-part question, that, because I would like to be able to communicate that to two of the couples of my kids who are trying to have kids to look at this. But the other side of it is, what can we do in the audience to help this movement?
Well, I talked to a gal last week who had the same question. She wasn't sure she was going to get them to read a book, but they did watch the Miseducation series, and it was very influential for millennial kids. They had never heard that before. So I would certainly commend that on Fox. I don't know.
I agree. Miseducation of America, it's a six-part series now on Fox Nation. We basically tell the abbreviated version of the book in film form, and we work with a great producer, John Case, who put it together and just did a phenomenal job. So if they're not going to want to read it, I think after watching it, they'll probably want to read it even more. And I think ultimately coming at the topic with humility to your kids, which is exactly what I'm going to do to mine someday when they're old enough to understand why we made all the choices that we made, is to be like, I had no idea. Neither did I. And so you're going to want the best for your kids. And maybe I didn't know that when I was going through because it wasn't so laid bare in front of me. But now I know, and you're going to want to know because I know you're going to want the best for your kids too. Like, do yourself a favor before they're 5 years old and read this book. And also, I think now COVID really did this too. Being more intentional, and I can say this to Californians as someone who's lived a lot in Minnesota, a very hopelessly blue state. Being more and more intentional about where you live, meaning the city and the county that you live in. COVID showed us how much more impact that local control can have. That's what I mean, what David's website, classicalchristian.org, has is a map where every school that's a classical Christian school is on a pin on a map. And I would move to a school. That's what my wife and I are doing, moving to a school. Just, I think it's that important that you can't say, well, here's the biggest problem though. We all pay property taxes. And we probably move to a place that's nice because of the schools and we pay those property taxes. And I think that's a hard thing to get past for some people, but ultimately, is that sacrifice worth the future of your kids and their souls and the way they view the world? So I think, yeah, tell them to watch the movie.
There's another benefit to this whole movement, which is, Pete refers to them sometimes as my school, that's good shorthand, but really I'm an association of members. So we just help these many independent schools. They're all independent. Outside of us, there are other organizations doing classical education. For example, Classical Conversations in the Homeschool is doing the same thing for homeschoolers. So if your kids can't afford, $7,000-$8,000 a year in tuition, homeschooling is a viable option, and there are many other options, pod schools. These are all, classical Christian education is 2,000 years old. Nobody owns it. It's all of ours. We just have to recover it.
Well stated. Over here.
Hi. I went through the whole Catholic homeschool, and I started my kid with that. He's college now. Graduated. But I had a big problem, like what you said about progressive plan. It was core curriculum. Even though we homeschooled, because I didn't have the money to go to private, we homeschooled Catholic through a school up here in California, Napa. They still had core curriculum that we had to do. And I stopped going there. I said, I'm not going to do that anymore. And I tried it, and we did other things for his schooling and groups. But then when we wanted to go back to high school for sports and stuff, they wouldn't accept him, like you said, accreditation. He had to go to an alternative school. And it was, I was so glad I was able to homeschool, because it just meant so much to me. And he turned out great. He's a Eagle Scout and all that other stuff we did. But, and so that was a big block for me. I said, why do we have to cater to this core curriculum still? And then one other thing I wanted to mention, I noticed that, I guess, LBJ, he decided he didn't want to have school buses for Christians and Catholics. And so even though we're public, we pay, like you said, all the taxes for getting kids to the public schools, he eliminated taking kids to Christian schools. And I'd like to turn that around also, and turn around the core curriculum thing. So how we do that.
The school bus thing sounds like a great challenge for the Supreme Court these days. I'm serious.
Yeah.
I think the core curriculum is part of how they consolidate the control, obviously. David, how do you navigate that core curriculum in classical Christian schools?
We don't.
They don't. I mean, if that's when you don't take the king's gold at some level, Not that you are, homeschooling is not that, but you're right though. I mean, if when the testing at the high school level requires the core curriculum aspect, that's how they try to box most parents in, and it takes a lot of extra effort to do it on your own. And that's why I think the next step is also, and we talk about this in the book, you know, the SAT just recently stopped testing for reasoning because reasoning is racist. And the same guy that took over the SAT is the guy who wrote Common Core, which was a federalization of standards under the Obama administration. So what David's linked up with is a, you know, classical learning test, a SAT for classical Christian schools. There's pipelines of curriculum for classical Christian schools. There's accreditations. Teachers' colleges need to be created. So it's an entire ecosystem that's going to have to live parallel to a progressive pipeline that controls every single aspect, to your point.
Michael, I think, has a question.
Yes, I don't know, you were born when my dad became president of the United States, so I don't know if you're aware, but when he ran for president of the United States the first time, one of the main things in his campaign was to get rid of the Department of Education put forward by Jimmy Carter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the one thing he's really upset with, after 8 years of being president of the United States, he was never able to get rid of the Department of Education. But I remember one of his great quotes is, you know, when we cease to be one nation under God, we're a nation gone under. And I quote that all of the time when I go out and speak to young people.
Fantastic.
Other than that, where can people get a list of these schools for us people who have grandkids now? My parents sent me to a military academy, so.
Ooh, I like that.
I'm telling you, I went to a place we called St. John's Miniature Alcatraz when I was a young guy. I was taught by the Sisters of Mercy. And then I went to the Jesuits. So God was having fun with me from the very beginning. But where do you get a list?
So I have to give credit to my wife, Stormy, in the front row. She's our webmaster, and she has developed a great tool that you can sort by state, city, just pins on a map, anything you want. Classicalchristian.org, school finder. She built that, and it'll get you there fast. And every school has its own page that you end up at because, again, we're an association of like-minded independent schools.
And to your point, the reason your dad, I would believe, is so adamant in getting rid of it is because he knew how and why it was created. We break that down in the book as well. I mean, a lot of the work that Rebecca has done focuses on that too. I mean, unions used to be conservative teacher associations, which were taken over by the unionization movement. Then that union movement turned around and endorsed its first ever presidential candidate in 1976. The teachers' unions had half the delegates at the 76 convention when they endorsed Jimmy Carter. When Jimmy Carter was elected president, he turned around and gave a gift to those very same powerful teachers' unions, which was the creation of the Federal Department of Education. And the NEA and the AFT openly bragged at that moment that there would be no Department of Education without the teachers' unions. So from the very beginning, the Department of Education has been a creation of those teachers' unions. And politically, they've tried to make it impossible for people who understand that to get rid of it, because then you're anti-education. Which was the problem among so many other weak-kneed Republican senators and congressmen of that era who wouldn't be willing to make that move. I hope we're at a point where, because of how corrupt the unions are, especially after COVID, that being against something like the Department of Education can be decoupled from being against education. They've corrupted it so much they've created an opportunity to expose it.
Yeah, we have time for one last question. I'm sorry, but we'll go over here.
Thank you. My grandkids are homeschooled, which I start to learn a lot about it. My granddaughter's a sophomore at Hillsdale. And Larry Arnn gets a lot of stuff out there. He provides courses for kids through high school. You can get them free. He has online courses you can take, no charge. It's just absolutely wonderful. The reach they have is just amazing. And that college is hard to get into. And they have a tremendous student body, and they have a code of honor like the military academies. You break the code, you're kicked out. And one of the codes that my granddaughter learned the hard way when she was still in high school, she lied to her mother. Bad mistake. And so I get the phone call. And Nikki said, talk to Emily. Problem? Yeah, she lied to me about not doing homework. So I called my granddaughter and I said, look, lying about your homework, not too good, but not doing your homework is simply a problem. You fix a problem, you own it, you fix it. Lying to your mother is a character flaw. You've lost her confidence. Never do that again. So when Hillsdale interviewed her, and with the code, she said, are we missing anything you think should be there? She said, yes, don't lie to yourself. And my grandson is just making Eagle Scout this month.
Congratulations.
It's a funny thing. I was just talking to Jason Chaffetz on his podcast about the book, and he was talking about his friend Trey Gowdy, and his friend Trey Gowdy said, you know what, in all my years of prosecuting, I've never prosecuted. They said, when he gets a question about education, he says, you know what, I've never had to prosecute a homeschooled kid or an Eagle Scout. And we've got two of them here.
Yeah.
So that's a testament to parents who've been ahead of the curve and willing to do something for their kids. And I think what's encouraging is that now there's a brick and mortar options and more online options too, to the point where we can get to a critical mass where we're pumping out 3, 4, 5, 6% of graduates in this country that can be a part of the leadership change for the future of the nation.
Each of you are going to have an opportunity to say hi to Pete and David at the book signing that we're heading to now. And I just, on behalf of this terrific audience, want to say thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Signed copies of The Battle for the American Mind can be purchased through the Reagan Library Museum Store. Every purchase you make from our catalog, website, or museum store is a critical component to our success. In short, your purchase supports our efforts to extend the legacy of President Ronald Reagan. Purchases can be made at reaganlibrary.com/store. To find a listing of all upcoming events, please visit reaganfoundation.org/events. Thank you for listening.
For more information on the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation and Institute, including information on how to become a member, information on upcoming exhibits at the Reagan Library, and more information on the legacy of President Reagan, please visit reaganfoundation.org. And don't forget to like and follow the Reagan Foundation on all social media platforms.
Until next week, thanks for listening. God bless you.
Don't forget to subscribe to A Reagan Forum podcast in your iTunes or Google Play stores and on other podcast platforms as they become available. New episodes of A Reagan Forum come out every Thursday. Like what you hear? Check out our Words to Live By podcast, featuring radio addresses and speeches Ronald Reagan delivered from the 1960s through the 1980s. New episodes drop every Tuesday. And don't forget to follow at Ronald Reagan on Facebook, at Ronald Reagan on Twitter, and Reagan Foundation on YouTube. Also, search for us on SoundCloud and Stitcher.